The subject of how to deal with war crimes has plagued the moral conscience of civilized man for millennia. In more modern times, after World War II, the Allies debated how to treat the Nazi leaders. What emerged from that debate, the Nuremberg trials, would become the precedent for post-war justice. But how to deal with war crimes in the terror era is another matter. Where war is ongoing, where civilian destruction is part of the enemy's plan, and the news cycle feeds martyrdom, how do we proceed? The debate over the fate of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and how the mastermind of 9/11 should be tried reflects this debate. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, William Shawcross. He's a distinguished journalist. He's covered international conflicts and conflict resolution for many years. He's the author of numerous books, including the esteemed Sideshow, Kissinger, Nixon, and the Destruction of Cambodia. He was a member of the High Commissioner for Refugees Informal Advisory Group. And his father, Hartley Shawcross, was Britain's lead prosecutor at the Nuremberg war crimes trials. It is my pleasure to welcome William Shawcross to the program today to talk about his new work, Justice and the Enemy, Nuremberg, 9/11, and the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. William Shawcross, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Pleasure to have you here. One of the things that is so remarkable as one goes back and reads and understands what went on with respect to Nuremberg is that many of the issues that we are debating and talking about regarding Guantanamo and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed really are so fundamentally different with respect to the prisoners at Guantanamo today.
Well, at Nuremberg, there was a big debate about how to deal with those Nazis who were captured at the end of the war. Stalin wanted to execute about 100,000 German officers just in vengeance. Churchill thought that about 10 senior officers could be put up and summarily executed. But Roosevelt and then Truman made a very different point, that justice must be seen to be done. And they insisted that there must be a court process, a proper trial. And Roosevelt appointed, and Truman sent off after Roosevelt's death in April 1945, a remarkable man, Justice Robert Jackson, who was a Supreme Court justice, and he was America's chief prosecutor. And within months, Jackson had set up and created, with the help of the Allies, including my father, who was Britain's Attorney General at that time, and our chief prosecutor, they'd set up an amazingly competent system for trying those Nazis who'd been captured. And the trial actually opened incredibly soon after the end of the war in November 1945 in Nuremberg.
One of the things that was so remarkable is how quickly, how swiftly that process went forward. And here we are 10 years later still debating how we're going to deal with the 9/11 terrorists.
I know it's an extraordinary contrast and not a good one. It doesn't reflect well on our times, I'm afraid. And you're absolutely right. The trial in Nuremberg opened in November 1946, and it was completed. All the evidence heard, and the charges laid, and witnesses testifying. All of it was completed by July 1946, and the judgment was handed down in October 46, and the death sentences were carried out in November 1946. It was extraordinarily fast.
Of course, there was no right of appeal in that process.
No, that's absolutely right. And sometimes people hold up Nuremberg as a template, as an example of what we should do today, and in some ways they're correct. But on the other hand, despite all the criticisms of Guantanamo and military commissions in the United States, it's important to note that any Nazi who was transported by time machine from Nuremberg to Guantanamo would be thrilled by the extraordinary privileges and rights that he had in Guantanamo that he did not have in Nuremberg. The criminals, the terrorists today, are far better protected than the Nazis were in Nuremberg.
It does seem clear that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will have more of a chance with respect to his day in court than the Nazis did even in Nuremberg.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And the crucial thing to remember is that whatever the criticisms made of Guantanamo by some people on the left, anyone convicted of any crime in the military court in Guantanamo can appeal all the way up through the federal system, through the civilian courts, to the Supreme Court of the United States. And that's an extraordinary privilege for what are terrorists, otherwise known as illegal, unlawful combatants who have massacred innocent civilians, not only in 9/11, but all over the world.
As you've looked at this, talk about the way in which you see this process and this debate differently with respect to the war on terror, because it is ongoing, because it is so amorphous in terms of its scope, and because civilian death and civilian casualty is so much a part of what terror is all about.
Yes, and it's been an extraordinarily difficult thing for the United States to cope with, and I have great sympathy for the U.S. government in these after 9/11. After 9/11, the U.S. government knew very, very little immediately in the immediate aftermath about the structures of al-Qaeda and the ambitions. One thing they did know is that bin Laden had said on many occasions, it is our duty and our desire to obtain weapons of mass destruction to use against the United States and its allies. And that was an overriding fear. So after 9/11, the principal, one of the principal ambitions was to capture al-Qaeda terrorists and interrogate them. And they did this, and as you know, three al-Qaeda terrorists, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, were waterboarded, and the Bush administration has never really recovered from that decision. They claim, and I think they're probably accurate, that from that waterboarding, masses of information was derived, some of which ultimately led to the capture of the discovery of the whereabouts of bin Laden himself and his execution by Navy SEAL Team 6 in May last year. But it was a difficult decision to do waterboarding. This is defined in many countries as torture. The Justice Department said it was not torture, but there's been an ongoing controversy over that ever since. Now, President Obama has taken a very different position, not capturing al-Qaeda terrorists to interrogate them with or without waterboarding. I'm sure he would not have waterboarded them. But instead, he has killed them by drones far more aggressively than the Bush administration ever did. President Bush used drones very sparingly. President Obama has used them very liberally. And over 1,000 people have been killed by drones in the first 3 years of the Obama administration, with very little criticism until recently. If Bush had done that, I think he would have been very, very severely criticized indeed of war crimes.
Of course, coming back to the prosecution of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others, the waterboarding and the enhanced interrogation has made it that much more difficult to set up the prosecution.
Well, yes, that is true on one level, and their defense lawyers, who will be very diligent on their behalf, they will have defense lawyers paid for by the U.S. government. They will be military lawyers, and military lawyers have shown themselves to be no pushover at all in these trials. They're very extraordinarily diligent in defending their clients. But all the information that derives from torture or whatever you call it, aggressive interrogation, will not be allowed in court. The defense lawyers will make an issue of it nonetheless, but the evidence will not be allowed, and the government will have to make its case independent of anything that derives from aggressive interrogation. And there was an interesting example of the problems that this causes. In 2010, there was an al-Qaeda terrorist who had been one of those who'd blown up the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya in 1998, killing over 285 people, most of them Africans, it should be said. About 12 Americans were killed. And he had been aggressively interrogated, though not actually waterboarded. And the judge, the civilian judge in the federal court in Washington, Judge Kaplan, said that the information that came out of his interrogation was the fruit of the poisonous tree, and it could not be allowed in court. And so his confession and all the evidence that he had bought the truck that was involved in the bombing and much more evidence was disallowed. At the end, there was an extraordinary situation, a rather awful situation arose, because there was one rogue juror who wanted to acquit him on all 285 charges. And in the end, the compromise was reached that he was found guilty not of mass murder, which he was undoubtedly guilty of, but merely of conspiring to damage government buildings, namely the embassies. Now, that's a pretty unsatisfactory solution for particularly for the victims of the families concerned. But the judge nonetheless threw the book at him and gave him a life sentence, which was, I'm sure, appropriate.
Talk a little bit about what has been the ongoing debate, particularly with respect to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, with regard to military tribunal versus trying him in federal court.
Well, it's a continuing debate, as you say, and human rights groups say that there should be no military tribunals, that everybody should be tried in a federal court, and they are perfectly capable of dealing with these issues. The Gailani case, which I just mentioned, shows the difficulty of that federal courts can sometimes get into. But one has to say that military courts may get into similar problems because, as I say, any information deriving from aggressive interrogation is not allowed in federal courts and is not allowed in military courts either. The principal differences now, and many of these differences have been watered down by legislation since 9/11, the principal difference is that in federal court, a prisoner has to have had a Miranda warning of his rights when he is arrested, and hearsay evidence of any kind is not allowed. In the military court, no one expects soldiers to issue Miranda warnings when they capture people on the battlefield or in safe houses where they're hiding. And some hearsay evidence is allowed with the permission of the judge. So there isn't really a huge amount of difference between the two court systems now. But I think one could say that the military courts allow a little more protection to the U.S. government and to the military than the federal courts would allow.
One of the issues that is an overlay to all of this goes back to something that Justice Jackson once said, that you should never put a man on trial unless you're prepared to see him go free. The United States government has already made it clear that under no circumstances is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed going free.
That's absolutely right. You're quite correct to point that up. That is a real sort of catch-22 situation, and it was a hostage to fortune. Obama, I think, and his Attorney General Eric Holder should not have made those remarks, but they have, and I suspect the defense will use them in court to say this is a mockery, this trial, because the government never has any intention of letting him go free anyway. So that is a serious problem, and Justice Jackson is something of a hero, I think, in this situation. And there's a new man who's going on the block, as it were, who is Justice Jackson's direct successor, and he is General Mark Martins, who is going to be the chief U.S. prosecutor at Guantanamo. And he's a very fine man, a military lawyer who was most recently deeply involved with trying to establish the rule of law in Afghanistan. And he has taken on this, I hope not totally poisoned chalice, of prosecuting the 9/11 terrorists in Guantanamo. He is determined to make the trials as open as possible and as proper in every term, that be seen to deliver proper justice to these people. And I think that you're going to hear a lot about him in the near future, because the pre-trial proceedings for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will probably begin as early as March. And so watch out for General Mark Martins, because he's a very fine man. And if anybody can make this work, he will do so.
One of the other uses, one of the other values of war crimes trials is creating almost a chain of events with respect to the history of what happened. Talk a little bit about that. It's certainly something that Nuremberg did.
Yes, you're absolutely right. When Justice Jackson went to Europe after VE Day in the summer of 1945, by the time he got to Paris that summer, he discovered that the U.S. Army had already brought hundreds of truckloads, or rather railroad car loads, of documents from the Nazi archives and offices in Berlin and elsewhere. And these documents showed in bureaucratic splendor all the war crimes in which the Nazis had been involved, and the crimes against humanity, the death camps at Auschwitz and so on. And Justice Jackson was astonished that anyone would have committed to paper the evidence of such crimes. And those documents were vital in the prosecution at Nuremberg, and they've been vital in establishing the history of the Nazi regime ever after. And all historians who write about the Nazi regime use as one of their fundamental sources, the documentation from Nuremberg. So it's been very important in that regard. I suspect that the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, while it will of course produce some documentation and some historical facts and histories that we don't know as yet, won't have quite the same educative effect for decades to come. Nonetheless, it will have an important impact in that regard.
Going back to the Second World War, why were the Japanese tribunals in Tokyo after the war less successful?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I think it's partly because in Germany, despite the horrors of fascism, there was a sort of common cultural bond between the United States, other Western European countries, and German memory or institutions, if you like. Germany was, after all, and is today, one of the most civilized countries in Europe. And legal processes such as the United States practiced, and Britain and France also, and not the Soviet Union, it has to be said, which was also sitting in judgment at Nuremberg, our Western legal practices were understood by the Germans, and I think that most of the German people accepted that Nuremberg was, on the whole, a good idea. There were some, of course, Germans and others who thought it was victor's justice, but on the whole, it was accepted as a reasonable result after the horrors of the Second World War. In Japan, there was no such cultural sort of understanding, if you like, or not understanding, identity of views. And the trials were not as well conducted, I think, also in Japan as they were in Nuremberg. But so the Tokyo tribunals didn't have the same educative or restorative effect, you're quite right.
How important, in your view, is public opinion in the success or failure of these war crimes trials?
That's very important. And it's very difficult, it's going to be very difficult for General Martins to get public opinion on his side, because there is so much propaganda, if you like, well, perhaps that's too strong a word, so much feeling against any kind of military tribunal. I think that General Martins has the best possible chance of winning over public opinion, because he is a fine man and quite clearly a man who has the interests of justice uppermost in his mind. But it's going to be very difficult to do, and everything that goes wrong, people will, the critics of this process and organizations like the ACLU and others will jump on and say, look, it's all a farce. These are kangaroo courts, which is how they've been described often by critics of the military system. One example of how difficult it is, not just for the military, but for anybody in these cases, is shown by the danger that some of the prisoners still represent. And for example, in the discovery motions for just one case, 600,000 documents have been amassed by the government, by the prosecution side. These all have to be handed over quite properly to the defense side. But before they're handed over, the government has to go through all of these documents to make sure that there are no paper clips or staples within them. Why? Because if paper clips or staples get into the hands of prisoners in their cells in Guantanamo, they can, and there are examples of them having done this, turn them into weapons to use against warders. There was a terrifying, awful case in New York several years ago where an Al-Qaeda prisoner had a plastic comb, and he sharpened one of the teeth into a needle, which he drove into the eye of a prison officer who suffered not only blindness but brain damage as a result. So these are still, some of them are still very violent men, and the process of rendering them justice and yet also protecting people around them is much more difficult than it is in many other cases, than most other cases.
And of course, the other aspect that I mentioned in the introduction is that we're dealing with a situation, a war arguably, that is still ongoing, and there is always the possibility and danger of more actions taking place during the course of the trial.
That's absolutely right. And after Eric Holder announced in November 2009 the Obama administration's Plan A, which was that Halicek Mohammed should be put on trial in Manhattan, there was an immediate row, and New Yorkers said, look, these people came here once on 9/11, we don't want them back here in any circumstances. And politically, the Obama administration had not done its groundwork adequately, and in the end they had to withdraw from this plan of having a civilian trial in New York. And in the end, the Obama administration had to withdraw its plan to have a civilian federal trial in New York and decided to hold it in Guantanamo after all. And that was obviously a defeat for what Eric Holder and Obama wanted.
And finally, do you think that it will be a successful trial? Do you think that it will serve the purposes of justice ultimately?
I think it will if the world lets it. There'll be a lot of criticism of the United States from its European allies, I regret to say. I'm afraid we in Europe are not often adequately cognizant of the fact that we only have a free Europe because of the United States, and we allow the United States to do our dirty work for us. But I think there'll be a lot of criticism from Europe and from elements of the human rights organizations within the United States also. And I think there's a very interesting contrast. Obama didn't want to get into all these problems of interrogation and handling of prisoners and trials and so on. And he has taken a very different line to that of President Bush. Instead of capturing and interrogating terrorists, he kills them by drones. And I would argue that execution by drones is a lot more not more of a final answer than interrogation, even harsh interrogation like waterboarding. But Obama has not had much criticism from that. It's just beginning now. And you could argue that if the criticism of the good faith attempts by General Martins and others to hold proper trials in Guantanamo, if that criticism just goes on and on and on out of all proportion, I think, then a lot of people in the U.S. military, lawyers and others, will say, well, drones are a better answer. It's a very difficult situation, and one which the British face also. I mean, there was a recent case in Afghanistan where we captured two British al-Qaeda people who were plotting against us, against Britain, and in the end, the British government was so nervous about the implications of holding them and being accused of or turning them over to the Afghans, in which case we'd be accused of complicity in torture. In the end, they were let go. It's an astonishing situation.
William Shawcross, the book is Justice and the Enemy, Nuremberg 9/11 and the Trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. William, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.